Good morning, everybody. Good morning, people. Good morning, Black Squares. It's nice to see everybody again. Okay, so penultimate. That means we have this week and next week. This week, I would like to sort of continue the topic that we were talking about last week. Last week, we talked about Rahav, right? Who was the first Canaanite that they met in Sefer Yoshua after they entered the land for the first time. And I presented the case of Rahav as kind of a test case to see or to test how rigid the command of killing all Canaanite inhabitants is, right? We saw in Sefer Dvarim that you have to, once you enter the land, we were commanded to kill everybody. We saw that was for fear of idolatry entering Israel, right? For fear of foreigner influence on the Israelites. And so they were commanded to just blanket, kill every man, woman, child. And which seems a little bit harsh, right? On the other hand, if the whole purpose of entering the land is to be able to properly worship God, and this is going to make that difficult, then maybe there is some sort of justification for that. In any case, we looked last week at a case at which here is a Canaanite, a woman, a prostitute, someone who seems to be the poster child for someone who can have negative influence on the Israelites. And we saw that she was saved. Which means that whatever her case was seemed to have trumped the command for cherem, for generally killing everybody. And we saw that her salvation was based on two main issues. The first one was she spoke of God. She confessed God's greatness. She spoke the language, right? She said how great God is. She seemed like loyal. She seemed to say all the right things religiously. And if the whole point of killing all the Canaanites was so that they should not be a negative theological influence, then posing her as someone who is, you know, one of us, who believes in God, who acknowledges God, then that kind of helped exempt her from this ban, from the command of ban. And she was later seen to be accepted into the community of Israel. We saw that at the end in chapter 6. And the second issue that we saw was her request that not only she, but that her family be spared as well, right? And her family, as opposed to her, we have no reason to believe that her family also is likewise theologically compatible. They were just Canaanites, right? They happened to be the family of a nice woman, but they were just Canaanites. And we saw that the reason that they were spared was also thanks to her chesed, right? That she took in these spies and she saved them. She tricked her own, you know, her own king and her own people. She lied to her own nation in order to save these spies, in order to help Israel. But that is that may not have been enough to save this family of hers. And therefore, she secured an oath, right? And she got the spies to swear to her that they will not kill her family once they come to Israel. And indeed, we also saw in that same chapter 6 that when Yoshua later told the people to go kill all the city, he said, but spare Rahav because of the chesed she did, spare her family because of the oath that you swore to her. Okay, so we saw that that was a case which seemed to be an exception to the general rule of killing all Canaanites. The second story, the one that we're going to be looking at today, the one of the Givonim, right, the Gibeonites, in chapter 9, that is the second, I think, test case for this command of killing all Canaanites. Like Rahav, this story also has an element of trickery. Actually, it's mainly based on trickery, except in this case, instead of tricking, like Rahav did, the Canaanites, the Givonim, we will see, tricked Israel. Okay, so that's kind of really, really pushing the envelope. And I think this is like another, as I said, test case to see whether whatever it is that they did was enough to exempt them and from the ban and spare them. Okay, and that is the story we're going to be looking at today. Again, I invite any questions, comments, whatever. Feel free to unmute yourself and say what you want to say. All right. The Gibbonim come, enter the story. Well, the story of Sefer Yehoshua starts with them first on the east side of the Jordan, and then there's this miraculous crossing the Jordan, which is kind of parallel to the miraculous crossing of the Red Sea. And then they enter the country and they first meet Rahab, and then they go and by, the miracle of Jericho, of Jericho, they walk around the city walls 7 times, they blow the shofar. It's a whole miraculous victory that they have over Jericho. Incidentally, there was one per and there because it was a miraculous victory, and they were supposed to realize that it is God who's giving them this victory. They were also not allowed to take any of the spoils of the city, because taking the spoils of the city would have kind of implied that, well, they're the warriors, they deserve the spoils, right? So specifically for the case of Jericho, because it was said to be a showcase of God's miracle, they were not allowed to take any of the spoils. And incidentally, there was one man whose name was Achan. He ignored that command. He took of the spoils, and he got himself into a lot of trouble. And he got Am Yisrael into a lot of trouble. And eventually, he and his family were stoned to death, even though he was Israelite. Right. So that shows, I think, that's the opposite case of
He's a
Rahab.
rock.
Yes.
Wasn't that during the Battle of Ai as opposed to Jericho?
That was when they were about to try to capture the Ai, and they couldn't capture the Ai because he had done this in Jericho.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. What I want to point out is that Rahab was spared, even though she was Canaanite, because she was theologically compatible. Let's call it that. Whereas Achan, even though he was an Israelite, once he behaved theologically wrong, he was kicked out. Okay. And now we have the case of the Gibbonim that I want to look at today. Before we look at the case of the Gibbonim, I want to look at the same chapter in Deuteronomy and Devarim that we looked at last week. Last week, I brought this as a background to the Rahab story. And last week, we started over here. Okay, I'll start over here again just to show you what we said, and then I'm going to go back to the few psukim that preceded. Okay, last week, we read like this. From the city states within the country that God is giving you as an inheritance, means within Canaan, Lo techaye kol neshama. Do not leave any soul alive. Ki acharem tacharimem hachiti haemori haknani hakrizi hachivi vayvusi. The list of the Canaanite nations, blanket ban on them all as God has commanded you. Leman asher lo yilamdu etchem lasot kechol tavotam asher asu leElohim v'chatatem lachrim le. So you have to kill all these Canaanites so that they will not teach you and influence you towards idolatry. Right. And that makes sense, because if these people are in Canaan and you are in Canaan and you all live together as one great happy community, right, then there's going to be commerce. There's going to be, some sort of friendly, neighborly exchange. And then there's the danger of negative influence. But the psukim that come before give you a wider view of the wars and conquests they're about to fight as they enter the land. And we're told like this: Ki tikrav el ir lehilachem aleha. If you approach a city to wage war against it, the first thing you do, Tanakh tells us, v'karata eleha l'shalom, aleha l'shalom. The first thing you do is offer peace. Don't go and right away start killing anybody. First of all, you offer peace. V'haya. Im shalom ta'ancha, if they respond with peace, ufatcha lecha, and they open up their gates to you, vaya kol ha'am ha'nimtzava yulecha lemas vavaducha, then all the people in that city that you were about to conquer, they will be your slaves, they will pay you taxes, but it will be a peaceful relationship. V'im lo tashlim imcha v'astayim cha milchama, but if they refuse this peace offering of yours and they decide to wage war, Vitzartalea, then you can besiege the city. God will give you this city, a promise that you will win this war, and you will kill all the males within. And the women and the children and the animals you could take as war loot. And you will benefit from all this bounty that God is going to give you from besieging and conquering these cities. Ken ta'ase lechol ha'arim harechokot mimcha me'od. This is the law for what you should do for all the cities that are very distant from you. Asher lo me'arei ha'goyim ha'elahema. Not from the cities in Canaan. What is that? The theory is, if you want to extend your borders, right, and go farther out, and you're about to fight some distant land, right? There is no danger that the people there are going to come to Canaan and they're going to live in your midst and they're going to influence you in some negative manner. Then, if they want to call peace and you want to have some outpost somewhere where you have slaves and you have tribute and you know, you could take the women and children and do with them as you please, that's okay. The problem that we spoke about in Rahab's house and Rahab's case was the Canaanites. Okay, I want to show you that there's two different cases here. Case number one is the cities that are far away. And the cities that are far away, you can either sue for peace, and if they want it, fine, they can serve you. Or if they don't want it, fine, you can kill them. Okay? That's the distant cities. The close cities, the ones that are in Canaan, there's no choice there. Those are the ones that you have to kill. Okay? That is the case of Rahab that we saw last week. Okay? That is the background for our story. Okay. Now we go to our story. Yoshua Perek Tet. Yoshua starts conquering the land. Once the kings, right, we said they're city-states. Once the kings of these city-states on the western side of the Jordan, here on the mountain and in the valley, throughout the country, right, the mountain, the valley, the beach, the shoreline, once they hear everything that Yoshua did, it doesn't say here, it's implied here, okay? Chitiyeh, Moriah, Knaniyah, Priziyah, Chitiyeh, you see, once all these kings of all these nations hear what was going on, Veitkabtsu yachad lilachem im Yoshua ve'im Yisrael pe'echad. They say, okay, here's this marauding army that's entering our country, it's just going to sweep through our country, is going to, you know, destroy all of us, let's band together, form a coalition, and all these kings form a coalition against Yoshua and against Am Yisrael to fight them, to kick them out. As opposed to them, V'yoshvei Giv'on, the dwellers of the city of Giv'on, Shamu et asher asa Yoshua li'Yericho v'la'ai. They heard what Yoshua did in the cities of Yericho and Ai. In other words, that he totally destroyed them. Let me just show you the geography of what we're talking about. Okay, they entered. This is the eastern border, the Jordan River. This is the Dead Sea. They entered from the east, right? They camped in a place called Gilgal. The first city they came to over here is Yericho, Jericho, right? And now they're going to move westward. And all the kings in this area band together. And the city of Giv'on, which is right here, okay? We're told that they heard what Yoshua did to the city Yericho and the Ai, which is somewhere here along the way. What do they do? V'yoshvei Giv'on shamu, they heard. V'yasu gam hema be'orma. Okay, they decide to do some sort of trickery. We are told right ahead that it's trickery. V'yilchu v'yitztayru v'yikchu sakim balim l'chamorayhem. V'nodot yayin balim u'mevuka'im u'metzorim. They go and they equip themselves with old ratty bags, right, for their donkeys and worn out wine skins that are all cracked and old, right? To look really, really old. Una'alayim balot umetula'ot braglahem, and totally worn out shoes, patched up shoes for their feet. Uslamot balot alehem, and clothes that are all worn out. And they take this kind of dried out moldy bread. Okay, so they put on the whole outfit. They dress up as something really old and used. They go to Yoshua's campsite in the Gilgal. V'yomru elav ve'el ish Yisrael. And they say to him and to all the people of Israel, quote, Me'eretz rechoka banu ve'ata kirtu lanu brit. We came from a faraway land, and now we ask that you make this brit, this covenant with us. So now I'm asking you, why is that what they say? Why when they want a covenant, first of all, why do they want a covenant? Presumably they want a covenant because they're just as afraid as the rest of the kings that Yahushua is just going to come with his army and sweep through them and beat them up. Okay, so they want to get on Yahushua's good side. It's in their best interest to have this covenant. But I'm asking you, why is it that they say we came from a distant land? What's the difference?
Because they're not the locals that could endanger Am Yisrael spiritually.
I don't know if they
know that.
Exactly, right? I don't know if they know that. I don't know if they read Sefer Devarim, right? Or if they were, if they heard when Moshe said this to Am Yisrael. I'm not sure that they know that. In other words, you know what? Let me be a little bit more explicit. Let me first say what you're saying to make sure that everybody understands what we're talking about here. Okay? They seem to be playing. Hold on. They seem to be playing on this first section that we saw before, right? They seem to be playing on the option of, well, if they're from far away, then they have the option of suing for peace, offering themselves as slaves, paying a tribute, and staying safe, right? I don't think they know that. Okay. I think what we have here is, I don't want to sound like a heretic, but I think that, again, these books were written with a certain message for us, the readers, in mind. And I think that whoever, Yahushua, in this case, wrote this story, okay, wrote this so that we will understand that this is the test case for that first section that we saw, right? What happens if somebody from a far country comes, but we are also told as the reader that this is trickery? We know that they live, we saw the map, right? They live smack in the middle of the country. So we know that they're, okay? So this is going to be a fine-tuned story in which we have to see whether or not their trickery would work and if it's legitimate for it to work. Before we read the last pasuk here, I want to know, why would Yahushua or the people, is it in their best interest or not in their best interest to have such a treaty?
Presumably, yes.
Presumably, yes. Why?
Because then they're not alone against all these pagans, so to speak, the local pagans.
Right. Are you ready to take the second step? The first step means that this is one less city that they'd have to fight. Mm-hmm. Right. Here's a city that's opening their gates. They're offering them as slaves. We didn't see that yet, but they're offering, friendship. Okay. So that's one less city that fight. And you already took it to the next step, right? If it's a treaty, if it's some sort of alliance, right, then not only they will not be enemies, but they're going to be on their side, right? So they have another force on their side, which seems to make it in the best interest for both parties for this treaty to happen. Okay. However, we have that nagging little problem from Sefer Devarim that says you're not allowed to make a treaty with people who are Canaanites. Okay. Now these people dressed the part of someone who came from very, very far away. If they live right next door like they do, they wouldn't look like that. They dressed up as some people who came from some really distant country saying, hey, let's make a treaty. Vayomru ish Yisrael el hachivi. Okay. The Israelites respond to these people who the author here is pointing out. They're the chivi. Okay. They are one of the Canaanite nations. Okay. We're not fooled. And they say, Ulay bekirbi ata yoshev ve'ech echrot lechabrit. Maybe there's something a little bit fishy here, and maybe you guys are locals. And if you guys are locals, how am I supposed to have a treaty with you? Because we're not allowed. He's not saying that, right? But it sounds like they're putting up a fight because of this command that we saw in Sefer Devarim that says you can't have a treaty with locals. And they're saying, well, maybe you're locals.
I can't help but wonder why they aren't going in with the other nations as fighting B'nai Israel. They're debasing themselves in a sense. Yes, they're being deceitful, but they're saying we'll be your slaves. So it's not like
they're not saying that yet. They will say that soon. But that, yeah, they're not saying that yet, but they'll say that soon. And you're right. Why don't they join this coalition of all the other kings that are around them? I have two things to say about that. First of all, it's an excellent question. One thing to say about that is that later, I don't remember if I brought it on the screen, but later they are also, once, spoiler alert, there's going to be a treaty. Okay. Once this treaty happens, they're going to be very fearful of the coalition because they're like traitors, right? Here you were one of our local, you know, nation states and you decided to go over to the enemy, right? So they're going to have a problem now with Yoshua's enemy. The only thing I could think of other than, well, we need this to happen for the story, for this test case, is maybe like Rahab, they realize that, you know, that Am Yisrael is going to win this war. So why don't we pick the winning side? That is the only thing that I can think of to explain this. Okay, that they're just picking the winning side. Okay, so we said that if this is the case of Rahab, we are now in this case of the locals. Okay, this is what we know. The Am Yisrael seem to be suspecting it, right? But we know, let's see what the case is with people who are from far away, right? They pretend to be from far away. What are the rules of people from far away? There's two options. Either they want peace or they don't want peace. If they don't want peace, kill them off like you kill everybody else. If they do want peace, which seems to be the case that the Givonim are trying to convince them, hey, we're from far away, we want peace, right? That's here at line number one. Okay. And then the terms are that everybody in the city will be your slaves and will pay you taxes. Okay, that's the subsection of the law that the Givonim seem to be presenting themselves as. Right? They said Me'erah Rechoka, and just like the Tanakh tells us, Kent Aser Lekol Harim Harechokot, right? Rechoka. That's what they are. As opposed to Rahav, who was this? Okay. Vayomru el Yoshua. They speak to Yoshua. Remember, they were just accused of perhaps lying, right? And they say, Avadecha anachnu. We are your servants. Okay, so now they're again playing into that legal clause of, well, if we're suing for peace from far away, then we need to be your servants. Vayomru elahem Yoshua. Miatem. Who are you and where did you come from? Okay, point blank. Vayomru elav me'eretz rechoka me'od. We came from a very distant land. Bau avadecha, your servants came from a very distant land. L'shem Hashem Elohecha. Okay, so now they're adding something, right? The first time they tried to just come and say, okay, we're from very far away, we want a treaty. They were kind of dismissed with, well, I don't know, who are you? Maybe you're local. We can't give you a treaty. Now they're saying for very distant land, L'shem Hashem Elohecha, right? For because of the great, I don't know, reputation, I guess, of your God, Kishamanu Shamo, because we heard his reputation, we heard of him, Beit Kol Asher Asa B'Mitzrayim, we heard everything he did in Mitzrayim, and also that was 40 years ago, and also more recently. What he did more recently, in the last 2 years, to the two kings of the Amorites that are on the east of the Jordan, which the Israelites just did recently, that they conquered, and then they defeated Sihon, the king of Cheshbon, and Og, the king of Bashan, Asher Bashtarot, right? So they say, we heard about all these wonderful doings that your God did. Vayomru elenu skenenu, and our elders said to us, and v'chol yoshvei artzenu, and all the inhabitants of our land, they all said to us, k'chu b'yedchem tzeda laderech, take provisions with you, u'lechu likratam, and go toward these mighty people, v'amartem aleihem avdechem anachnu, and say to them, we are your slaves, v'ata kirtu lanu brit. And now they say, give us this treaty, right? This is exactly, right? Again, I'm going back to Devarim again. If they respond to you in peace and they open up their city to you, And everybody there will be your servants and pay you tribute. That's exactly what they're offering here. And they're bringing proof. This bread that we're holding was hot and fresh when we left our homes to come to you. And now it's all dried out and moldy. When we filled these wineskins at home, they were new. And now they're all dried up and broken. And our shoes and clothes have been totally worn out by the long distance that we have traveled. In other words, they're bringing some sort of proof. You know, we really are distant. Okay. And now I'm asking you, what do you think Yoshua and the people should answer them? Is this convincing? Is this not convincing? Is this convincing enough to override the command to kill Canaanites if these are Canaanites?
Were they supposed to ask the Urim V'Tumim or something like that to somehow ask God?
Okay, you know, that's a very sensible and very responsible suggestion, right? Here's a case. We don't know what to do. Let's ask God. You know what? We even have a Navi, you know, right? Let's ask the Navi. Let's ask God. Let's get Uritum. Let's figure it out. Okay. Before we see how they responded, I would like to show you, some similarities and one glaring difference between what they did so far and what Rahav did. Okay. Let's first look at Rahav. When Rahav speaks to the spies, she says like this, "Kishamanu tasherovish Hashem et meyam suf miftichem." We heard what God did in Mitzrayim. We heard what God did to the two kings on the east of the Jordan. Right? She's mentioning God and his great reputation. They did the same thing over here. Right? Shamanu shemot kol asher asav Mitzrayim. We heard of God's, you know, great deeds that he did in Egypt. The second thing that, you know what, let's just skip here. All right. The second thing that Rahav says is, we heard and we were very fearful, right? They don't say we heard and we were very fearful. If anything, they say we came because we heard of God's greatness, right? Rahav then goes on to say, "Ki Hashem Eloichem o Elohim b'shamayim imal v'alatz mitachad." God, your God is the God of the heavens and the earth, right? He is God. Notice how there's no parallel statement here. They have the, we heard of God's great deeds, right? Which is, these are the great deeds, the wars that he did. But there's no real religious statement, confession, whatever. And as a follow up, you know, to all these statements, Rahav says, "And now please swear to me, I did you chesed, do me chesed and save me and my family." Their conclusion is, therefore, we would like you to give us a treaty, which is similar to, right, Rahav. We will be your slaves. They say slaves here. They say slaves there. It seems like, I think, if you look at these two, it looks like what Rahav was playing on in order to exempt herself from the ban, Rahav was playing on the religious, the theological element, the theological argument, right? In essence, she wasn't saying this in so many words, but she was saying something like, don't worry, I'm not such a pagan Canaanite, you can accept me, right? If we're supposed to kill all pagans, all Canaanites because they're pagans, she's like, okay, I'm not a pagan. It seems like what they're doing is not the same thing, right? They're saying, if you're supposed to kill all the pagan Canaanites, we're not Canaanites. Right? That's the second half of the argument, right? She's playing on the theological, don't worry, I'm not going to harm you theologically or religiously because look, I'm glorifying your God. I'm accepting, acknowledging whatever words you want to use there, right? Don't worry, I'm not a pagan. So it's okay to accept me. And eventually they do. The Givonim are mentioning God, right? But their main ploy seems to be the Avadecha, the Eretz Rechoka. The argument of not that we're not pagans, they don't make any religious statement to parallel Rahav's, they seem to be, you know, banking on the, don't worry, we're not Canaanites. So we're not going to influence you in any negative manner, right? You're all safe, all is good. Okay, that seems to be theirs. So in Rahav, we saw that her life was spared because of, you know, her little nice speech here, right? And we saw that her family was spared because of the chesed and because of the oath. They're not doing any chesed, right? And they're not making such an impressive speech. So it seems like a step up, right? If we're testing the command to kill all the Canaanites, okay, so here's the next step. Can we kill somebody who pretends to not be a Canaanite? Well, if they're really not a Canaanite, then yes, right? We know that. But what if it's an iffy situation like this one? Then what they do, and, you know, Shelley said, well, we should ask God. And I think that's a great idea. What happens actually is, Vayikhu ha'anashim mitzeidam, ve'et pi Hashem lo sha'alu. Okay, I think that is exactly addressing what you suggested, Shelley, because these people took from, the people means the Am Yisrael, right? Am Yisrael partook of their provisions, which I think means, sounds like the kind of meal that you have together before you make a treaty, right? There's always kind of a ceremonial meal. But it's explicitly saying, Ve'et pi Hashem lo shalu. And they did not ask for any divine guidance here. Okay, I think we can... I think we could safely say that the author of this particular section is criticizing these people for having anything to do with these imposters, right? And for not asking for guidance, for not figuring it out. And I want to go back to why are they doing this? Okay, why are they so seeming so eager? And I'll even prove it. I'll even drive the point home by saying they partook of these people's provisions. Right? What do we know about these people's provisions?
Old and no good.
Old and moldy and dried out and gross. Right. So they're. I'm not sure you can make a meal of that. That makes it, I think, feel even more that they're really, really trying. They're really looking for some excuse, or they'll do anything they can in order to have this treaty, right? And I'm emphasizing again that we said before that it's in their best interest to have this treaty, right? Because one fewer nation to fight, right? And one more people on that side.
What's the alternative for provisions? They've crossed the Jordan. They don't have any money anymore. Where are they going to get food from? They've only conquered two cities. Where in the heaven's name are they going to conjure up food from?
Well, that's a good question. That's a good question, except I'm gonna challenge you on that on two points, okay? Point number one is, I would think that if their need for provisions was an issue before this story started, we would have heard about it. The story would have started with, and Am Yisrael did not have any food because the man stopped, or something like that. And that would have given us the background to say, well, what they're looking for is provisions, right? But the background to this story was the kings formed a coalition against them. So it seems like the background to this story that we're supposed to read the story against is a military threat and not a lack of food threat. That's one thing I would say to challenge you. The other thing I would say to challenge you is, let's say you're right and they need the provisions. I don't know how many Givonim came, but I cannot assume that they had enough moldy bread for 600,000 people or you know, 40 years later, 2 million people, whatever it was that they were. They certainly didn't have enough food for all of Am Yisrael. So even if they had enough food to share a meal with Yehoshua and the elders, I don't think that that's going to solve their hunger problem. So you're right that, you know, food was an issue there, but I don't think this meal that they're having together is solving that problem. I want to look at the next pasuk, which I think is really the key to our story here. After we hear that they did not ask for divine guidance, Vayas lahem Yehoshua shalom, Yehoshua made peace with them, Vayichrot lahem berit lechayotam. And he cut a covenant with them, or he made a treaty with them to keep them alive, which is, you know, what they wanted, right? Vayishave'u lahem nesi'ei ha'edah. And the heads of the people gave them an oath. And I'm asking you here, you know what? I'm going to challenge you here. What problem do I have with this pasuk?
They're not giving anything in return.
Okay, first of all, they're not getting, well, maybe. Okay, maybe brit means, like we said before, some sort of alliance, right? Anybody attacks you, I'll help you out. And anybody attacks me, you'll help me out. Maybe. Okay, and that will be something in return. Except I want to look specifically at this shvuah, okay, at this oath. Yoshua is not giving them an oath. Yoshua is giving them a treaty. And the heads of state here are giving them an oath. And my question to you is, what is the difference?
Hold on. It's not clear who is doing the swearing. Who's doing the oathing?
The Nesi'ei Ha'edah, the heads of Am Yisrael, I guess the heads of the Shvatim or their elders or the people chosen to represent, you know, the next level leader under Yoshua.
Do they have the authority to do that in the face of Yahushua not doing it?
Very good question. Okay. First of all, who gave them the authority if Yahushua didn't do it? I'm going to put that on hold, okay, because we're going to see that's going to be an issue. But before that, I want to ask you, what is the difference between, what is the legal difference between a brit, a treaty, and a shvuah, an oath? Is there any difference, or is just, you know, one and they just make a treaty and the oath, you know, seals it?
Treaties are bilateral, and an oath is unilateral.
Okay, that's one major difference, okay? Treated, like you said, Susanna, thank you, are bilateral, right? We have a mutual agreement, right? You and us, let's say in our case, a non-aggression pact or a whatever, military assistance treaty or whatever you want to call it. An oath is usually made by, I'll ask you, is it usually made by the stronger party or by the weaker party?
It can be either way.
Weaker.
It could be, well,
either way,
it's usually made by the weaker party if they want to, like, maybe convince somebody. Like, I swear I'm going to do what you say if you just help me out or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's often made by the stronger party because that way the weaker people will trust them or they'll feel beholden, whatever. Okay, mm-hmm. But it's more of a one-way thing.
You had treaties between stronger peoples and weaker peoples. The point is that in ancient times, when you made a treaty, there were terms and conditions. If you keep the treaty, then we will do such and such and such and such and such and such. But if you don't do the treaty, there's a klala section, an oy vavoy section. And that's a huge difference. Whereas a shvua obligates you to behave a certain way, whether the other party keeps their end of the bargain or not.
That is fantastic. Thank you. I really appreciate that. That was the second thing that I was hoping that somebody would say. Okay. Great. A brit, besides being bilateral, a brit is usually conditional, right? A brit means, like, we have brit with Hashem, right? Ayayim shamoa tishmu, right? If we listen to God, then God promises whatever. And if we don't listen to God, to the mitzvot and Torah and whatever, then God is going to punish us with whatever. It's an if then kind of treaty. A shvuah is I'm blanking out on the word I'm looking for, but it's non-conditional, right? It just is. And a shvuah is like it's a vow. You don't break it, and there's no request for anything in return, right? It's just a shvuah, and there it is. It's an oath. If you remember in the Rahab story, the shvuah, the oath, is what helped rescue Rahab's family. She requested that oath, right? She asked the spies, please swear to me that because of the chesed I have done to you with you, you will save my family, right? And they gave her that oath. And later Yoshua said, well, save her family because you swore to her. Here, if you notice, the Givonim are not asking for an oath. They asked for a treaty. They're not asking for an oath. Okay. So one thing we're going to have to figure out is why is it, or what do we think about the fact that these Nisi'im, whether or not they have As we heard before, I don't know if they have the authority to give this oath, but they're giving an oath, okay? And what, you know, what impact it's going to have on the story. But it's different, right, than the Brit. That's what I wanted to point out. Okay, they didn't ask for this. They got this Shvua. Okay.
One point.
Fast forward. Sorry.
When Jacob was heading to Laban, he made a oath with God also. He said, if you'll do, and if you'll do, and if you'll do, and keep me alive and bring me back home, then I'll believe in you. But, you know, the that oath of Yaakov was also conditional.
Right. It's funny because somebody told me that yesterday about a different oath. They keep bringing up that oath of Yaakov, right? And my response there was, well, I'm not teaching the Yaakov story, so I don't have to answer that. It's a question, all right? It's a question. You can, you know, whether or not you want to, I'm sure you will find plenty of Mefarshim who criticize Yaakov for making such a thing. Like, don't say, you know, you will be my God if, right? Or I'll build you this Mizbeach if. Like, who are you to say that? You're in a terrible position, right? So I think that anybody who learns that story, that is a major question they're going to have to look at. Thankfully, right now we're not looking at that story.
But even with the Rachav story, the people had to be, her family had to stay with her. They couldn't be somewhere else. So there was a condition put on that oath of saving the family as well.
Okay. All right. Well, that just means that, you know, it's a stipulation for the oath, right? We're only responsible for them when they're, you know, if they're with you. Okay. I want to look at what happens. Fast forward 3 days. Okay, they make this oath, this treaty, and they swear the oath, right? And you know, 3 days later, v'himikseh shloshet yamim achrei asher kartu lehem brit. 3 days after they make this treaty, v'yishmeu ki kirovim hem elav uvekirvo hem yoshvim. Somebody finally took out the map, right, and realized, hey, these guys that we just made a treaty with, they're locals. Oh no. Now what? Vayisu bnei Yisrael v'yavo el arahim v'yom ha'shlishi. So they go to the cities of these Gibeonites have five cities, and they go on the third day toward these cities of the Gibeonites. Here is a list of their names of the cities: arahim Gibeon v'akfirah be'erot v'kiryat yarim v'lo hikum bnei Yisrael. And the Israelites, remember that they're on their tour of killing off everybody and conquering the land, and they did not strike against these cities. Why? Ki nishbe'u lahem nesiei ha'eda b'Hashem Elohei Yisrael. Not because of the treaty, right? They swore to them because they saved them, or they didn't kill them because of the oath. Okay? Why because of the oath? I think you know, it's pretty clear, because if we say that a treaty is, you know, is a two-way thing, and if one person doesn't keep up their end, then the other side doesn't have to keep up their end, right? If it was just a treaty without the oath, then as soon as they realized that they were being tricked, right, this whole treaty was based on misinformation, right? It was based on a lie. If we did not have that oath, right, then the treaty would fall, because one side was being dishonest, okay? So now we have the next question up, okay? They gave the treaty. The treaty was mekach ta'ud. It was a mistake. It was a whole big deal, a big problem, right? But there's this oath, okay? So now we have the question. Remember that this all starts with, we're supposed to kill all these Canaanites. We didn't kill Rahav because she's not really a pagan. We made a treaty with these Gibeonites because they're not really Canaanites. Uh-oh, they are Canaanites, they are pagans, but now we have an oath. Okay, so now we have to weigh what is going to trump what. The Deuteronomic command to kill these people, or the oath that they made. Okay, because now they backed themselves into a corner, now they have to figure this one out. Vailonu kol ha'eda al nisi'im. If we asked before, did they have the authority to give this oath, which wasn't even asked for, now all of the people are now really, really angry at these, their leaders, for having made this oath. Vayomru kol nisi'im el kol ha'eda, and the heads of you know, the Nasi'im, the heads of their other tribes who had made this oath, all together defend themselves, and they say, Anachnu nishbanu lahem b'Hashem Elohei Yisrael, we took an oath in the name of God, ve'ata lo nuchal lingoa bahem, and so now we cannot harm them. What are we going to do? Zot na'aseh lahem, this is what we're going to do. We're going to go back to the original stipulations as if they were from faraway city, as if they sued for peace, right? The original legal stipulations. We're going to keep them alive. God will not be angry at us for reneging on this oath, right? Because if we right now go and kill them, then we're going to be going against this oath in the name of God, and that's a problem. They'll then live. And they should be woodcutters and water carriers for the people. Kasher dibru lahem anasim, as they originally stated, right, when they said, let us be your servants, right? So this is, you know, they're adding a few words here, but presumably we don't get the whole conversation. Okay. So what are they saying? They're saying, you're right, the brit was a mistake. It shouldn't have been a brit, but if it was only the brit, a brit, I think we're looking at all the possible cases. A brit that was made on mistaken pretenses would have fallen. That would not have been enough to save these people. They should have been killed. Brit, yes, brit, no brit. If they are Canaanites, they should be killed. However, if we already have an oath, it was a mistake, it was trickery, it was, you know, whatever you want to call it. It was a big mistake. Okay. But now that we have this oath in the name of God, that's something that even trumps the need to kill all these Canaanites who are sitting smack in the middle of the country. Yehoshua calls them and says, Lemor, lama rimitim otanu lemor? Why did you trick us to say rechokim anachnu? Mikem me'od. Why did you trick us and say, you know, you're from very far away, v'atem b'kir ben Yishev, but you're sitting right here in the midst of us. V'ata arurim atem. Now you are cursed. V'lo yikaret mikem eved v'chotbe yitzim v'shovei mayim levet Elohai. From now on, forever. All your descendants forever will always be woodcutters and water carriers levet Elohai for the house of God. Okay. Vayanu at Yehoshua. The Givonim now respond to their, why did you trick us? And he says like this. Ki hugad, hugad lanu lavadecha, sorry, because your servants were told, et asher tziva Hashem Elohecha et Moshe avdo, latet lachem et kol haaretz, v'lashmid et kol yoshvei haaretz mipnechem. Because we were told that your God commanded Moshe, his servant, to give you this whole land, and he should destroy all its inhabitants. V'nira me'od l'nafshotecheinu mipnechem. And we are very, very fearful of our lives. V'naaseh et hadavar hazeh. And therefore, we did this. V'ata hinenu b'yadecha katov v'chayashar b'enecha lasot lanu aseh. And now, we are in your hands. Whatever you see, you know, fit to do to us, do. Vayas lahem ken, and Yehoshua heard this. Vayatzel otam miyad bnei Yisrael velo haragu. And he saved them from the hands of the Israelites, who then didn't kill him. Which kind of, I think, implies that had Yehoshua not saved them from the Israelites would have killed them. Okay? Oath or no oath, the Israelites would have killed them. We're going to get that to a second. Set them as water carriers and woodcutters, like, right, according to the situation. Now I'm asking you, we seem to have some sort of machloket here, right? The people think that despite the oath, they should be killed. And Yehoshua says, no, they should not be killed. And I'm asking you, why is it that they should not be killed? Why did Yehoshua save them?
Yehoshua was making good on the oath that the princes had made, even though they shouldn't have made it. It wasn't a good idea. It was a bad idea, and so on and so forth. But nevertheless, in order to not embarrass the elites, he saved the Gibeonites from the people.
That's interesting that you're saying that, because I never even thought of that. Okay, I never thought of upholding the oath means that the princes would not be embarrassed, right? In other words, it's their good name that's at stake, right? Because they swore this oath, so it's their good name to say, we'll see in a minute. That is not necessarily the princes who were worried about. Okay,
but yes. Can help him.
Right. It was. Okay, we'll see that. But I want to say one more thing before that. Yes, he saved them, presumably because of the oath, right? But he also saved them after they said this little speech of theirs, right? When they said, oh, we heard of God's greatness, we heard of that, and we were very, very fearful, okay? And I think this may add another element. It's like, I think even the text is uncomfortable with keeping these pagan Canaanites alive, even though there's an oath, right? We have to do it because of the oath. But I think we also want to hear that they acknowledge God, that they are fearing God in some way, not like Rahab, okay? These people are still saved by the skin of their oath, right? But I think there's still sort of element of saying, you know, Yeshua needed to hear some sort of confession from them.
Now, this gets more complicated than Shmuel with the story at the time of David, when there was that.
I'm going to get to that. That's my last slide.
Okay.
You keep doing that, Shelley. You know too much. Okay. Let me just look at quickly at the Gibeonim's tactics in this story. Okay. The first thing they said is, "Well, we're from far away, so we want this treaty, right? Meaning we're banking on your Devarim thing, and let's see if that's good enough." That wasn't good enough because Bnei Israel called them out and said, "Well, maybe you're locals." The second thing is they said is, oh, we heard about God. The third thing they said is, Veniram, and we were very, very fearful. It sounds to me like since this whole thing is a dialogue, they say we're far, they say, well, maybe you're not. They say, well, we came this, and they say, okay, we'll give you this breed, we'll give you this shvua, and then Yoshua yells. There's this whole back and forth, I think, which makes it sound like the Gibeonim are like reaching. Let's see, you know, what thing can we say next that's going to get us out of trouble? Which sounds, I think, a lot less sincere than Rahab, certainly. But it seems to have passed the test of here is another group of people who we're going to exempt from this ban. And Rahab and the Gibeonim are the only people, the only Canaanites recorded in Sefer Yoshua that were exempt from the ban. All the other kings, all the other cities that they approached, they killed everybody.
Let me add also that the water carrier and the woodcutter, those are the absolute lowest parts, maybe except for tanners, the lowest parts of society. So they are not likely to be very influential when they start, spouting their own theology.
Great, thank you for that. I want to look at the importance of the oath here. Okay, we have only 5 minutes left, but I want to quickly look at the oath. You know what? We're not even going to have time to read this Rambam. This Rambam says, why do they even trick them? There's this whole issue of, you know, one of the things that the Rambam says, when Yeshua came, he could have said, open us for peace, but from distant cities. Or he could have said, you know, if you want, you can get up and leave. Right. And there's some midrash that says that one nation, the Girgashi, moved out to Africa and that's how they were saved. And why do they do it? Because the Gibeonim didn't believe it. Whatever, we're going to skip this Rambam because I don't have time for it. But I want to look at what Shelley said in Sefer Shmuel. At the end of Sefer Shmuel, we hear this following story. V'hira'av b'mei David shalosh shanim, where we're skipping forward 500 years. Okay, 500 years later, there was some famine in the days of David for 3 years. Vayvakesh David es pnei Hashem, and David goes and asks of God, what is this about? What can I do about it? Vayomer Hashem, and God says, El Shaul, because of Shaul, ve'el Beit Hadamim, the house of blood, al asher hemit et ha-givonim, because Shaul killed the Givonim. Now, this is 500 years later. We don't even have an explicit, there's a hint. But there's no explicit place anywhere that David explicitly killed the Givonim. There's one hint where it may be. It may also be in Nov, right, when he killed all the people in Nov, maybe, since that was a Kohen city, maybe they were still woodcutters and water carriers there. In any case, 500 years after this oath, Shaul seems to have killed off the Givonim. And because of that, there was a famine for 3 years as punishment. And the king calls the Givonim and he says, what can I do to make things better? And the Givonim says, you know what? I want you to kill off seven people from the house of Shaul, from the descendants of Shaul. And the kings and David HaMelech says, fine. And he kills seven of Shaul's descendants. Okay, I think that gives us, and again, I'm going to say this for the third time, this is 500 years later. Okay, I think this gives us some sort of sense of how important it was to uphold this oath. And we hear in the Gemara in Yevamot, V'haktiv, we have in Dvarim, Lo yumtu avot al banim. Fathers should not be killed for their sons' misdeeds, and the opposite, right? Sons should not be killed for their father's misdeeds. So why is it that Shaul's seven sons were killed for what Shaul did, right? That's not fair, right? And it's wrong. Amar Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, these rabbis said, Mutav sheteaker ot achat min haTorah. It is better that a letter from the Torah should be cut out, which means the whole Torah would become invalid, which means it's better to eradicate the whole Torah. Ve'al yitchalel shem shamayim b'parhesia. And there should not be a chilul Hashem. There should not be a case where God's name is desecrated, which is what happens when you make an oath in God's name and then you don't uphold it. Okay? So that oath is so important. It is more important than the Torah. It is more important than, you know, well, certainly what it said in the Torah to kill the Canaanites. Okay, so in other words, they did a very, very big mistake, right, by making this oath. But once this oath was made, then these people were saved. So now we have the two cases where there are exceptions to the three cases, right, where there are exceptions to the rule of killing all Canaanites. One is if they're not Canaanites. One is if they're not pagans. And one is somehow if they manage to extract, even by mistake, an oath in God's name, then that is going to save them again as well. Okay, that is what I have to say. Questions, comments, and complaints are taken out.
Fabulous, fabulous, fabulous.
Oh, thank you. Anybody else?
It still doesn't answer the question of why God, 500 years later, seems to be siding with the Givonim as opposed to...
siding with the oath. The oath has to be upheld no matter what. I think that's what it's all about. It's about this oath.
Okay.
See you all next week.
Can I say something parenthetically, please?
Even not parenthetically.
Pardon?
Even not parenthetically.
Okay. I remembered that there is a book called Chop Wood, Carry Water. And I didn't remember what it was about, so I just checked while we're learning. And it's some Zen kind of book. And there's a zillion questions. Well, where does the phrase come from? And everyone attributes to Zen masters. And nobody takes the moment to see that it's from the Torah.
Very interesting.
Like I said,
I don't know enough Zen to know when Zen was written. So Zen may have preceded this. I have no idea.
No. This is a book that was written in the last generation. Not to worry.
No, Zen. I mean, I don't know where Zen.
Right.
Okay, I agree with you. That was parenthetical.
Right. Thank you.
But there you go.
So you raised
You
raised the question about they didn't need the Shavuot as long as they agreed to believe in Hashem and to be under their rule, they could have saved them anyway.
But they did not. They did not Rahab. They did not say that they, you know, accepted God or believed God. Sorry. Again, they did not seem to acknowledge God in the same way that Rahab did. They needed something else to save them. I think yes, Asher.
Yeah.
I put in the chat, this is it was a segue, but in the case of Yaakov, he did not make a shvua, he made a neder. A neder is not a shvua, and a shvua is not a neder. And the whole point of this story actually underlines that, because shvua specifically uses Shem Hashem, and there's a big difference.
I'm going to use that next time anybody brings up Yaakov. Thank you. All right, then. See you all next week, God willing.
Thank you so much. Thanks, everybody, for
coming. Stay warm.
Yeah, I see snow outside. Have a wonderful day. Stay warm if you're here in North America. Enjoy your week. We'll see you soon.
Just to make you feel good, there was hail in Yerushalayim yesterday. Didn't stick, wasn't very much, but it did hail in Yerushalayim.
I was wearing short sleeves in Yerushalayim yesterday. Not impressive. Bye now.
Bye-bye. Thank you.